Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast where all politicians don't die, they just fade away. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, I'm my partner in propaganda and Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
In this episode, we're going to talk about what happens when politicians leave high office. There's the Enoch Powell truism that all political careers end in failure. But that's maybe not true for Mahathir bin Mohamad, who's the Prime Minister of Malaysia again at the age of 92. And by my calculation, Steve, that means that Tony Blair is going to be Prime Minister again in 2045.
I shall await the day with great trepidation, simply because I want to see Jeremy Corbyn's face.
I want to see all the hot takes on Twitter. On that happy note of optimism, let's have some music. The inspiration for this episode was an article by Anoush Shakilan in The New Statesman talking of the Ed Miliband renaissance, in which he says that Ed Miliband has been sassy on Twitter, he's been doing death metal voices on Radio 2.
Which was hilarious if you've not heard it.
He's doing an entertaining podcast, which inexplicably got nominated for an award instead of us. But this sassiness, she also says, was noticeably absent for the 5 years of his leadership of the Labour Party. And she's got a point, hasn't she, Steve?
Yeah, she has. The Ed Miliband we're seeing today is a completely different beast to the Ed Miliband that was leading the Labour Party previously. The person we're seeing now is quick-witted, funny, interesting, engaging. The Ed Miliband we had before was robotic, bland, and just did not come across well in any form.
No, it's a very different Ed Miliband to the one that gave seven identical responses to the same question.
I think you'll find that what's very important is that we need to get everybody around the table and discuss a solution to the problem.
Well, indeed. Is one problem how authenticity in politicians is perceived? It's almost become like a holy grail that everyone needs to aspire to.
Yeah, I think when it comes to that, politicians seem to view being authentic as though you're just the same as everybody else. It means you're a common person. It means you enjoy all of the same things that that everybody else does. It means you enjoy going for a bacon sandwich down at the local cafe. It means you enjoy the Arctic Monkeys like Gordon Brown did. It means you are latching on to something and trying to present yourself as being like everybody else because somehow that makes you more relatable. When in reality, authenticity is about just that, being authentic to who you are. Some of the best cases you can see of authenticity is actually Jeremy Corbyn. Like him or loathe him, you know exactly who he is, you know exactly what he stands for, and you know exactly what he wants to do in the general broad strokes if he were to become Prime Minister. You never had that with Ed Miliband. You never really had that with Gordon Brown. You never had it with David Cameron. And you definitely never had it, really, with Tony Blair. Even though his messaging was very strong and people knew what he was going to do, that was down to political messaging rather than authenticity on his part.
Maybe the most authentic thing that a mainstream politician has ever done on television is go on the one show and talk about their hobby of collecting manhole covers, which is what Corbyn did last year in the general election. In the weird parallel universe in which Jeremy Corbyn was a new Labour cabinet minister, if he'd have talked to Alistair Campbell and said, I'm going to go on national television and talk about manhole covers,
he'd been left out of the room.
I think he'd have been sworn out of the room, but maybe I've watched too much thick of it. There is a definite thing in what you say of politicians trying to seem like ordinary people rather than be themselves, and Corbyn is definitely very good at that. And it reminded me of The Political Brain, which is Drew Weston's book, which sees things from a very US perspective. But he talks about two examples maybe of this kind of fake authenticity. One of them is Gore in 2000. So Al Gore, passionate about the environment, is one of the things that really got him going, did the Inconvenient Truth films after leaving the vice presidency. Except his political consultants told him not to talk about the environment in the 2000 election because he was told it wouldn't win any votes, even though it was the issue that he cared most about. That you could easily talk about that issue and show passion and communication in a way that would actually make you popular.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really the thing that seems to be lacking in an awful lot of politicians, that, you know, you would say lack authenticity. It's that you can never say what they're passionate about. You could probably, you might be able to name what their policy proposals are, but you couldn't say what they're passionate about. That basic notion of this is what this person stands for being missing is a massive problem for a politician. Because if you can't do that, then why would anyone vote for you?
And again, that's probably why Al Gore's reputation is much better now than it would have been in 2000. Because now that we've seen he has issues that he's passionate about and causes that he really cares about, that's a lot more popular than going on television and giving the latest talking point or remembering the latest stats on the economy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I would agree 100% with that.
The other example he gives is John Kerry in 2004, and John Kerry of course made his name testifying against the war in Vietnam, various abuses of power that took place, and his political consultants gave him the advice of saying nothing about Abu Ghraib and the abuses that were going on there, because they thought it would be unpatriotic to criticise the president while a war was going on. So instead, generic issues we're talking about, which the whole point, one of the main things about John Kerry was his war record and was his ability to speak truth to power. Mm-hmm. And that authenticity got completely torpedoed in the quest to try and look more like an identity kit politician.
Essentially, with Kerry, they went, oh my God, normal people aren't going to like this. We need to make sure that, you know, we're presenting John as normal, therefore we won't talk about this. Which, again, if you're not being talking about something you're passionate enough, or you can't actually drive some passion into your campaign or into what you're talking about, then really you're just going on a road to nowhere. Because ultimately, and I think this is definitely the case moving forward, given we have rejected quite strongly, I feel now, the Tony Blair style of spin, that very machine-focused and polished presentation of a politician, I think would not do as well in the current climate as it did in 1997. So why are we still trying to replicate that? Or why are politicians still trying to replicate that? You can see some progress on that for this front. As you say, Corbyn, very authentic in and of himself. On the right, even though we point at him, we laugh at him, we find his views abhorrent in a lot of ways, Jacob Rees-Mogg, 100% authentic. It's why he's charming in that weird, eccentric kind of way. And that's what makes him dangerous as well. But because that's exactly who he is. He is the person that campaigns with his nanny. The fact that he doesn't hide it and try and embraces it is exactly why he can hold the kind of the favourable opinions of people.
So if we move on then to maybe another factor that affects one's perception of a politician after they've left office, and that's what they actually do and say. And again, to go back to Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, I think you can definitely see that the one's reputation has enhanced since he left office and the other one has definitely decreased. Mm-hmm. Gordon Brown, for all that we remember the slow car crash of the premiership, his reputation is much better now than it was in 2010. And a large part of that is because he has done a lot of charity work. The profits from his memoirs went to charity, and he's made occasional interventions in the Brexit referendum and in the Scottish independence referendum with tub-thumping, passionate speeches. And a lot of people seem to think that his interventions towards the end of the independence referendum actually tipped the balance a little bit and stopped that. It looked a bit tight towards the end of that campaign. It looked like the polls were tightening. There was that one poll that had yes ahead, and it could be that Gordon Brown could have headed that off and had a big part to play in keeping Scottish independence. On the other side of that, Tony Blair's reputation, strange though it is to even think about, is even lower than it was when he left office in 2007, partly because he done a few dodgy deals with people in dodgy regimes, partly because he has accumulated a lot of wealth for himself, which seems a little bit unseemly, and partly because every 2 months he has another intervention into British politics. I think people are getting a bit tired of it, frankly.
The key thing, if you're a politician who's had their day and you're looking to try and recover your standing with society, is shut up, hide yourself for a bit, and focus on charity stuff. Or focus on things which don't profit you directly. Because if you do that, you know, you can end up being rehabilitated. Look at Ed Balls. Granted, the things he's been doing haven't been like charity focused, but they're definitely not really of any benefit to him. They're just very entertaining.
I'm guessing you're referring to his report on Bank of England independence, which was very entertaining.
Oh, 100%. That and Strictly Come Dancing.
Or maybe the report that he did with some Harvard academics on the prospects for a UK-US trade deal.
Yes, that and the time he appeared on the Great British Bake Off and Would You Lie to Me?
I still think it's the Bank of England report that really gets it for me, though.
You would, Corey.
You get
would.
YouTube clips of that all the time, whereas... Anyway, I think when you think partly of the reputation of politicians, how it gets better after leaving office because they can be a little bit more honest and a bit more authentic. Maybe there's also a little bit of nostalgia that comes in as well. And we've talked about this a little bit in terms of the love for John Major, in that lots of people, now that John Major's making interventions on Brexit, people are going, oh, what a political colossus he was. Why don't we have anyone as principled and amazing as John Major nowadays? Which seems a little bit like, I suppose every generation looks back at the past with rose-tinted spectacles, don't they?
Almost certain. If you went back to Attlee and Churchill's day, where they were facing each other across the dispatch box, people were probably going, wouldn't it have been wonderful if we still had the Chamberlains and we still had George Lansbury or people like that? After a while, people's reputations do recover, which in turn means that you view them more favourably, which means in turn when you're dealing with people who are active and just by virtue of being people making mistakes in front of your very eyes, you go, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could just turn back the clock and go back to those political giants we used to have?
I wonder if another reason is because the generation of politicians we've had over the last 10 or 20 years, not many of them are in Parliament anymore. Mm-hmm. So George Osborne has left, Ed Balls has left, David Cameron has left, David Miliband has left.
Purnell's left.
James Purnell, Hazel Blears.
Jackie Smith.
So, and that's just off the top of our head,
That's an awful lot of former New Labour ministers who've all left, and that's before we start counting Blunkett, Straw, and a load of others.
John Cotton, of this parish, often talks about the famed Labour leadership election of 1976 when Wilson resigns, in which you have James Callaghan, Tony Benn, Michael Foot, Tony Crosland and Dennis Healey. I think what's interesting, what those five have in common, is they were defeated in elections, lost their positions as ministers, stuck around in Parliament, won power back and stood as minister again. So Callaghan was Chancellor and Home Secretary before in the Wilson government of the 60s, before he was Prime Minister. Wilson, of course, was Prime Minister twice, when he won in 64 and again when he won again in 1974. And that doesn't happen nowadays. Either ministers stand down or leave. And we've also seen people like Tristram Hunt and Jamie Reid and now Heidi Alexander and Lewisham leave Parliament mid-term to go off to other jobs and other careers.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those interesting little kind of changes. I mean, we like to talk about career politicians, but I feel like it's not so much people kind of looking at, oh, my career isn't progressing, but more them looking at it and kind of going, I don't feel I can do anything here. I mean, there's a reason I feel like Andy Burnham went for the mayor of the Greater Manchester area rather than stick around on the front bench. It's because he could do more there. There's a reason Dan Jarvis went for the South Yorkshire mayoralty as well. It's because they feel like there's more for them to do there. Just being on the back benches doesn't get you that much, which is true unless you are approaching being a backbench MP in a very specific way. Or one of two specific ways. You can either do it with the kind of the social worker approach, where you are just there entirely 100% for your constituents to just make sure that they've got the help and support they need. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a very honourable way to be an MP. And the other side of that, as a backbencher, you've got what I would call the Stella Creasy approach, which is just choose some campaigns, hammer them home, and hopefully be very good at campaigning so you can actually get some changes made, as Stella Creasy has done. But ultimately, what you do end up with is a lot of people who don't, you know, they're not natural social workers, and maybe they don't have the right kind of campaigning capabilities that Stella Creasy has, so they don't see the kind of success which is enough to keep you interested and keep you going and keep you passionate about being in the House.
Hmm.
So when another opportunity presents itself, you go, well, why would I stay here? this is better.
And I suppose a lot of it about seeing politics as a career is that if you don't feel like your career is going well, after 2 or 3 years, you do try and find a different job. Mm-hmm. And there are merits and there are demerits to that, I think.
Yeah.
The problem, I think, is that people like James Callaghan, people like Harold Wilson, people like even Tony Benn were able to learn from their mistakes and can come back and be wiser, better politicians for that. And that's not something that's ever going to happen to James Purnell. And sorry, prospective centrist party, if you're listening, David Miliband is not going to come back either. So there's a lot of talent that's lost there. Maybe one reason why a lot of people talk about how we don't have the giant politicians as we do of the past, maybe partly it's because for the last 20, 25 years, governments have had to come into government with a completely blank slate, having never really done it before. So in 1997, I think Margaret Beckett had been a junior minister in the Wilson government, and that was about it. Back in 2010 then, I think Ken Clark had been a minister. There were one or two, but there weren't very many. Certainly they'd been junior ministers, but no cabinet ministers, I think, apart from Clark. Mm-hmm. A future Labour government under Jeremy Corbyn will have very few people who've been ministers before.
In fact, none, I would argue, based on the current front bench. I mean, everybody who was a former Blair or Brown minister has basically gone to the back benches. Is there anybody?
No, I think John Ashworth worked for Gordon Brown in Number 10. I don't think he was a minister. I don't think he was an MP at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked before about Theresa May not really appointing new talent.
Yep.
And what could happen if the likes of James Cleverly, Dominic Raab, Tom Tugendhat, who I still refuse to believe is a real person, if those people aren't appointed to the cabinet, you're going to end up in a future Tory government succeeding the Labour government I've just talked about. If those people are still MPs, they won't have had the cabinet of minister experience either. So again, it's a whole generation of MPs who essentially they're having to learn government from day one on the hoof. And it's very, very difficult to do that. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn will go from being a backbencher, having been part of Stop the War Coalition and done that, and to be leader of the opposition. But that's really, really different to being Prime Minister, in the same way that Tony Blair had to as well, Tony Blair had never run anything particularly before in his life, and then is Prime Minister over the whole of the government. And it's not surprising that actually you're not seen as being that effective in government by comparison with the past.
Yeah, because ultimately you don't know what you're doing to begin with, and people's perceptions of you are made and broken very, very quickly. And that goes for governments as well as individuals. And so if your first year, whilst you're trying to find your feet, is filled with gaffes, well, guess what? You're going to be a gaff-prone government, regardless of what the rest of the time is, because that's all people are going to remember.
And I feel like then each political party almost overcorrects and makes different mistakes depending on how the other party has fared. So, for instance, the first 4 years of the new Labour administration from 1997 to 2001, some people see them now almost as wasted years because that was when probably political capital was at its height and there was potential for radical change, but it didn't really happen. And then David Cameron tries to learn from that, and in the first few years of the coalition, tries some very radical policies with Andrew Lansley, with Michael Gove, which, I mean, honestly, didn't really, well, A, weren't that effective in the case of Michael Lansley, and the case of Gove reforms have really come back to bite the Conservatives politically. So I'm sure the next Labour government will overcompensate again for the mistakes the Conservatives have done, and the whole terrible cycle will carry on.
Essentially, that lack of long-term vision, or long-term memory, rather, from benches means that when they get into government, a political party just panics and goes, ha-ha, this is exactly what we need to do to avoid this former pit trap. We won't do that, we'll do this instead, which of course creates new problems. And because you've not had somebody who was there before going, actually, Jeremy, you don't want to do that, you want to do this.
And I wonder if part of the reason why politicians aren't sticking around as much and leave the public eye quite quickly is almost because we're in a mass media age of social media, 24-hour news and what have you. Reading John Bew's biography of Attlee earlier this year, and Attlee was leader of the Labour Party for 20 years, just about, which is a mammoth amount of time.
That is insane.
And you can't imagine any political leader being on the front bench for 20 years anymore, I don't think, in that glare. I mean, I know Blair and Brown were at the top of British politics from, I mean, Blair, what, 94 to 2007? Yeah. Well, I'm not sure in the age of Twitter that would have lasted, to be honest. Yeah.
No, I think, I mean, it's often said that, you know, the age of social media means that our attention spans are shrinking. The news cycle has sped up rapidly. And I think there is some truth to that. There always needs to be a story for the media to report on. And ultimately, things which would have been overlooked before, because you only had so much space that needed to be filled. But now, well, we need the clicks. We need to fill this time on 24-hour and rolling news. We need to ensure that we're covering things that are going to get people engaged, because ultimately our bread and butter as the media is the number of people we're getting to our website or buying our paper, which means we need to drive that narrative and we need to report on basically anything that could be can deliver us cash.
Damien McBride, in his book on working for Gordon Brown, talks about how Brown would say that a politician really only has 7 years before the public start to tire and get sick of you, and would give examples from British politics or American politics supporting that. It's an interesting idea that I haven't really tested, but I wonder if, A, that maybe does make sense, but also in the age of social media where you're constantly exposed all the time, maybe it's not 7 years anymore, maybe it is going to be much less than that, as you say, because there's that much scrutiny over every little thing.
I suspect whilst it probably would change a little bit, I don't think it would be actually a radical shift. You're looking 6 years rather than seven. And I say this because actually the amount that most people pay attention to social media and things like that is quite slim. When you look at what stories break through to people outside of the political bubble, which ones resonate, you know, most of the toing and froing of political manoeuvring and stories don't make it through to the general public's consciousness. And there was quite an interesting study actually for about Donald Trump actually. Some surveyors basically asked, do you read Donald Trump's Twitter feed? And the vast majority of people said, no, we don't. They didn't follow him. They didn't actually engage with it or engage with him in any capacity. The only time they really saw stuff was if somebody else retweeted it into their timeline or if the media reported on it. So even arguably the most important Twitter account in the world actually doesn't get as much kind of coverage as you might think, and people don't pay that much attention to it. So if that's Donald Trump's Twitter account, then to be quite honest, most people are going to pay even less attention to the Sun's Twitter account or the Sun's Facebook posts or the Telegraph, the Mail, whatever it may be.
I think it was something like 4% of users, 4% of Americans read Donald Trump's Twitter feed, which probably means it's probably only about 10% of them that listen to this podcast.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But when you think about actually Trump's trying to use Twitter to go round the established media, that actually maybe more people would have seen Trump unvarnished if he'd do something like Roosevelt's fireside chats on the radio or do a kind of televised address.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact that Trump would be terrible at those is another thing. But yeah. But generally speaking, yeah, Trump would probably do better at reaching people directly through some more traditional means than actually engaging with Twitter.
And talking about a politician who hopefully soon will have left frontline politics seems like a nice way in which to end. If that's not such a clunky segue, it kind of is, but we'll go with it. You can read more takes on politicians who have or have not resigned on our website, notenoughchampagne.com, and on our Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo and Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune. I'm at Pepperback Writer.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting.